Welcome. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island-chained nation in the sunny, slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which is good for the economy, because now everybody can get a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest... we've got two guests here. We've got Bradley Keith and Professor John Searle. So when we introduce Bradley first.
Brilliant. I love that introduction, Vinny. That was outstanding. Yeah. Bradley Lockerman here. I am the filmmaker of the John Searle story. And I met John about 20 years ago in Colorado. He told me a story that was absolutely the most off-the-wall thing, the wildest story I'd ever heard. And at the end of it, 40 minutes he talked to me about this. At the end of it, I just looked at him and I said, "You're a movie." But then I started to get into this thing and I started to receive some of the data and receive some of the numbers and some of the books and some of the empirical proof of what this man's life has been about, what he's done, how he's done something so extraordinary that he had to be, in those past days, kicked to the curb. He had to be pushed to the outside. He did this all in the UK. He did it mostly, we can review where he was throughout his life, but mostly in and around the area of Reading, Mortimer, Warminster, where the Warminster mysteries came from, and different things. Now, what he did is created the Searle Effect Generator, which in the early days had this enormously long name, which I'll remember in a moment. But then, by suggestion from a Japanese physicist, change it to Searle Effect Generator. What it is merely a system of rotating magnets that are able to harvest the spare electrons that are found on the rare earth materials. And this man did this in 1946. He was employed at British Rewinds at the time. His job was basically as an electrical engineer apprentice. He worked with magnets, coils, undoing them, putting them together. But then the dreams that John will talk about, the dreams came into play because he was in the right place at the right time for those dreams he had as a boy to be interpreted. And he found within this realm that he now lived, hey, what I remember comes to this form, it is this type of generation, and the generator device itself, like I say, it's more aptly named a converter. It converts ambient electrons, temperature, radiation, if you will, and takes the random energy into a uniform output through this converter device, where you have enormous output at the end, clean, green, no input. The input, of course, is on the quantum level, taking advantage of the motion of electrons.
Mm. So naturally, it would break a few oil monopolies if it was to come out. So
I should say so. And, you know, it's interesting because he comes up with it in 1946. He subsequently is employed by Midlands Electricity in the 50s, and he's challenged at Midlands. We can talk about this as well. Midlands challenges him because he's hired as a foreman, one of three men as a foreman in charge of 11 areas where his basic job as a very young man is to troubleshoot. They have unique problems, and they take them to this brilliant young man who says, "Oh, I have an idea. Let's fix it this way." Well, his co-workers and the people underneath him began to chuckle at him because he had this wild idea, and he wanted to build his device and, you know, make it legitimate, have people examine what he was doing. So he was challenged, and John will talk about that as well. And upon that challenge, built the device, showed the device, and then people said, "Well, okay, that's nice. It's a novelty." Why? Because it's the 1950s. And what's the great big energy breakthrough coming out of 1945? Nuclear. Why would anyone want to switch? Very few people were aware of anything like poisons. We got you, John Roy. They were very they were not in tune with the fact that nuclear power would sooner or later have poisons and have all kind of trouble. So through the 50s and then through the 60s, what he discovered with this device is it had a unique levitation capacity, and John will talk about that as well. So through the 60s and then into the 70s, he developed this device based on what it could do and not what he wanted it to do. So we'll explore that as well. And I see, did we lose John? Is he?
Yeah, we just lost him. I was just thinking about this as well, because at the time nuclear power was coming out and becoming popular, and placing these gargantuan nuclear bombs that can destroy all human life on Earth on fault lines all around the world. You know, it's just like, oh, mate, this is a brilliant idea. You know, this will really advance society.
Hey, Vinny.
Any time something goes wrong, though, it'll kill the entire planet through forced sterilization of everybody's spam, but it'll be fine otherwise.
You know, it's you either laugh or cry, because back then they were thinking, let's build a bigger one, set off a bigger one. Let's see a really big one go off over here. But you know, I'm old enough to remember a lot of that. In fact, I grew up with the duck and cover type stuff. I see John's popped off. Good, we're getting him back on. So we can walk through the history, and then if it's all right with you, I've typed in one of our advisors from our science advisory board. Maybe at some point we can bring him on to comment. Now, what we did in the last multiple years was we set up an infrastructure so that John could develop his device in a very sober, business-like atmosphere. So he would be protected, and at the same time, we could develop this thing in full view of people that may object to it. And I think, Vinny, that the paradigm is shifting. I believe that almost everybody everywhere realizes that we have to get off the burning of the fossil fuel type of thing. So a lot of the emergent technologies that are coming forward are getting some good attention from the from the large powers that be. I think even they realize we've got to change this paradigm in how we get energy.
And we're having a little bit of trouble here, of course, getting John back on the line here. And we've added your friend there, I believe it's Amar, to come on with us if it's possible at some point, if he ever accepts the Skype request. So, sorry about the technical issues today, ladies and gentlemen. But anyway, unfortunately, it looks like we're going to have to continue without John. Do you have a phone number for him? If so, Bradley, just please put it in the Skype chat for
me.
Can ring him on that and bring him up.
Yes, let me do that right now for you.
Yeah, that'll work. Energy in itself is now become, in my opinion, absolutely essential to the day-to-day human life. You know, you need energy to chill your food, energy to cook your food, energy to produce to power the pumps that bring the water into your home, energy to heat your home, energy to cool it down when it's too frickin' hot. Energy for everything. And it occurs to me that, of course, if you're going to control all human life, control the energy supply. And if somebody comes out with something that, threatens your current monopoly of the energy supply, let's just take that out.
Yeah. Let's somehow get control of it. Now, one of Searle's primary directives, if you will, was that no one company, no one country, no one person or entity should be able to own this, because what we're tapping into here is not just what the Searle device does, but things like the ECAT and others of these emergent technologies that are just delving into the quantum level, because there is an enormous amount of energy in a quantum level. We found that out with relativity and exploding things, but Searle says very succinctly that instead of smashing that atom into bits, hitting it with a hammer, hitting it with a neutron, blowing it up, you can influence those electrons through magnetic fields. You can induce them to flow within a current. And that goes back to James Clerk Maxwell and the Lorentz equations and a piece of mathematics that our man Amar Vakil will talk about called quaternions. They kept a lot of this quiet because in those days, J.P. Morgan and the people that controlled the U.S., so to speak, wanted the ability to sell energy through a metered system, and be able to have this enormous monopoly and make money that way. Now we are tapping into that unlimited source on the quantum level. And all we're doing is saying the electron, and, you know, we hear all this about, that's perpetual motion, or that's this, or that's that. It violates the second law of thermodynamics. It violates entropy. Sorry. You want to talk about perpetual motion? I give you the electron. All things are in motion. We know that. All things are in movement all the time. Throughout the universe, everything is moving and everything is spinning. And it's the spinning aspect and moving aspects that makes this thing not just viable, but something that we believe, and I think a lot of people believe and have seen, especially in the academic world, that we're moving towards a re-examination, if you will, of the quantum level regarding physics.
Now, the other element here is I find whenever somebody wants to outlaw something good, they create a new law. And so if you want to outlaw somebody who's going to create something that creates unlimited energy, you create the law of thermodynamics to say that whenever they do it, oh, you're violating the law, you know, they're a bad person. I wonder if anybody's ever gone to jail for violating the second law of thermodynamics.
Yeah. What is the prison sentence for that, or is that like straight to the chair?
Yeah, I think it's more like straight to the chair, powered by a free energy device, you know, it'd be quite funny.
Well, you know, we have, as our chairman of the board of Searle Technology Incorporated, a man named Phil Talbert. Phil Talbert worked with Dr. Paul Brown in the late 80s and early 90s. And Dr. Paul Brown is mostly noted for his nuclear battery. But interestingly, we know that Paul Brown constructed a Searle-type device. And his Searle device, as best he could make it run, actually burned up some enormous thick wires because of the output that this small unit. He didn't make a full SEG. He just wanted the inner ring and the inner set of rollers. And his thing went wild. And it wasn't an SEG, but it was on the principles of spinning magnets. It got so energized that it completely melted a 1/8-inch copper cable. So what I'm saying here is that Phil Talbert, who guided the infrastructure for Paul Brown and his true effort, the nuclear battery. Now, just real briefly, the nuclear battery, if you think of a triangle, you think of point A, point B is the thermal, and point C is your output. This is your input, point A. Point B is thermal. Point C is output. Every frame of reference in terms of energy is how do we get from point A up to the thermal and then to point C. And what Searle contends and what so many people are now on the verge of contending and proving is that you do not need point B, the thermal component. You do not need heat to get energy. You can go straight from A to C. Paul Brown had the nuclear battery. Searle, of course, has a Searle effect generator. And there are some other emergent technologies that are out there and I believe are going to and should get some credit along with Searle's efforts.
Now, we've been trying to get him on during the course of the segment so far. We're going to be coming up to a break relatively soon. I believe he's in the United Kingdom, isn't he?
Yes. Okay. Did that number work I sent you?
No, it didn't. You need the international calling code beforehand. It needs to be split up in a number of ways. But don't worry, we'll get him. We'll talk about this and sort that out over the break. I was just wondering why is it that we always have to go outside of our home in order to get electricity to come into it? You know, wouldn't it be great if you had the ability to just move somewhere, set up a home, and have it be self-contained? You know, it produces its own energy, it produces its own water, there's no grid to go down. I mean, imagine what a city that has no grid would experience during an earthquake. It'd be like, oh my God, the grid's not down because there is none.
Yes.
That'd be great.
And absolutely, say hello to the Searle device. The Searle device is designed as a 15-kilowatt unit. It is in and of itself a prime mover. It is in and of itself a unit that will provide unlimited electricity because there is no friction, and there is within it you have what Searle calls a linear motor traveling on a magnetic bearing. You have these rollers that travel and float on a sea of electrons, so they don't touch, they're lifted. And at the same time, a magnetic field holds that in place, and it spins at a tremendous RPM, so that the output at the rim of this device is stepped down to a controlled 15-kilowatt unit. 15 kilowatts, stick it in your home. You can run anything on your home ad infinitum. Because there is no friction, there are no parts to wear out, this unit will be put in your will and willed to your generations following you. Now, another important thing about the Searle device is it is scalable. We say 15 kilowatt. Okay, what if you want 100 megawatt? Suppose you want something even larger. You know, what we'd like to do, and we've talked in different fashions, we've talked to some of the people in Las Vegas, for example. You've got a particular casino, and I've always wanted to go into the casino owner and say, what's your electric bill in a given year? And suppose, you know, we could have this SEG for you, stick it in the Las Vegas casino, and eliminate that electric bill. I mean, what would their electric bill for all those lights and everything be for a given year? Millions? 10 million? Just for electric? Let's eliminate it.
It'd be something ridiculous, and maybe they wouldn't have to rip people off with putting synthetic pheromones into the gambling rooms and make people feel more comfortable losing all their money. We'll be right back after the break.
We're gonna make love. You know how I know? Because it's Wednesday, and Wednesday night is the night that we usually make love.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the interrupted show by the guests. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Broadcast live 5 days a week on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. There ain't a whole lot of rules on this show, apart from the domineering kind of management structure that we have here at AmericanFreedomRadio.com dictates that we must have fun during the radio broadcast, and I attempt to, you know, make sure that frickin' happens. And in my opinion, this show is probably the most fun show anywhere, really. If you're talking about how ruthlessly dominated the entire human race is getting by cryptographical scumbaggery agents that simply take over all the power structures of society and make it their own, there aren't really a whole lot of laughs to be had, except on this show. Now, we have, I believe, our special guest, Professor John Searle, on the phone line there. John, are you there?
Yes, yes.
Excellent. And we're also joined by Amar Vakil as well on Skype. Amar, welcome.
Hi, welcome. Thank you.
Okay. So, Bradley, you kind of seem to be the stoker of the fire here and taking us in a nice direction. So you brought on Amar for a particular reason, or should we hear from John first?
Yeah, well, gosh, just quickly, Amar Vakil is heading up our science advisory board with a number of people that he'd be glad to speak about. But yeah, I think we go to the good professor John Roy Robert Searle over there in England. John Roy, I was talking about in the 1950s. When you built the unit, because you were challenged by Midlands Electricity, maybe take us through that story.
This story is called Once Upon a Time in the Midlands. Go ahead, John.
It's Once Upon a Time now, because it's a long time ago. The trouble was that my boss heard the people, the workforce, laughing at me. And he said, John, you cannot carry on with this nonsense of this machine. They're laughing at you. Now, you've got three options. That was nice of them. First, pack your bags and go. Second, shut up. Third, do it. So I said, well, I like my job, so I don't want to pack up and go. Secondly, I can't shut up. Said, I'll do it. So they said, I'll put down what you need and we'll see. And they said, well, we don't have the rare earth. We would have to get that you would have to pay for. But then the cost was only 39 cents per kilo. A little bit different today, I must say. And they got it. And, of course, these people are still magnetic people. So, and we have our own three-phase power station. So we have all the power available to experiment. And when they did the cutting and that, and I said, I want you to magnetize that rare earth. They said, it's impossible. I said, hit it with all the power you've got. I want to know what happens. Of course, you know, I'm making an order, so they do it. Then when they take the ring out, they find bolts and screws all rushed towards it. And they came in, they said, look at this. I said, well, that's exactly what I expected to do. And then, of course, the rest was done. But what we have to bear in mind, that the government had already set their plans. Nuclear power would be free. That is what we would do. I knew different. I knew nuclear power would be a costly thing. But they would not listen. Well, at least I proved to myself that the HEG could be made. And that machine kept running until, what, was 1979, when it was confiscated by the authorities.
And John, explain for Vinny's audience, the most unique thing, obviously, was from 1946, when that thing, what happened to it from your kitchen table in 1946?
Well, the first thing I want everyone to understand, it was not built in the kitchen. It was machined at the other factories. And all I had to do was press it together and then carry out the test of what I expected to be what a power-producing device. And, of course, all the technical data said that gravity would not let it lift off unless you apply a lot of force. So it was quite safe to put it on test in the kitchen. At least that is what I accepted from the scientific world. There's no problem, but your rollers won't stay on. You roll, if you do, and you try to move, they'll fly off. Well, that didn't quite happen that way. What happened when I start up, I had calls outside to start kick it. And of course I said to the landlady, plug it in. She said, will it blow the fuse? No. You plug it, and it shot up to the ceiling, and she jumped up with it. He said, I thought you said it wouldn't do nothing. It would stay there. I said, well, I should have done. I get a step ladder. I go to put it down. And I couldn't. So I asked him to come up with a big screwdriver and ram it in there and stop those rollers moving, which it did. Then the trouble was I got down with it, but it was so cold I couldn't get my fingers off the bars I put there to carry it, because you had to get warm water. So we have now had a problem. A, why did it live? Secondly, why was it so cold? And it took another 6 years of experimenting before we found, A, it got cold because the electrons coming in was greater than the electrons going out from it. Secondly, it rose from the table to the ceiling because it became superconductive. And that meant the magnetic field of the earth forced it upwards. So we now solve two problems which scientists was not aware of. But it didn't stop there. We had to do quite a bit more research work. If it wants a body, give it a body.
And John, you were mostly looking at what you had done and deciding to pursue what it does rather than shape it into something you wanted.
That's good. That's correct. If you want to fly, give it a body.
And what happened after the 1950s when you left Midlands and the 13 old age pensioners showed up?
That's why they supported me. They wanted, you know, they heard about it and they wanted to see it done. They want to see this happen. If you could have put a body on it, let's see what you could do with it. And it was trying to design a body. And the way I wanted it, I wanted to be sharp edge so that it would cut through the atmosphere. Now, at the moment, I was not aware exactly what was happening at that rim. So we made the body, and of course, what happened when we powered up, we had this ring occur on the ground, a burnt sort of ring. And when it went and lift, it tended to lift the grass with it, the earth. We had the scientists to check the earth, and they said, there's iron in it, and what you're causing is that you're beaming a magnetic field and forcing that ring, but it is energizing all that iron particles in there. So when you lift, it tries to follow you. So the ground lifts. So I had to work on this problem, and it was simple to solve. All I had to do was reverse the way I was laying up the materials. Problem solved.
And so that's when you took the rare earth material from the outside rim and put it in the center.
Yeah, in the center of the SEG, as we now call it.
And that allowed that electron flow, thinking of the center as a reservoir of spare electrons. And once you've harvested those electrons, it leaves a positive charge, therefore allowing new electrons to be drawn in. Is that correct?
It's an absolute circle.
And, John,
and it's an open device.
And John, explain for Vinny's wonderful audience that you explored this with the P-Craft. Talk about the P-Craft.
Well, the P-Craft, there's a number of things we needed to know. A, why did it always look dark underneath and seem to reflect the colors of the surroundings to it? If it goes over the trees, it looks like a military khaki type of, you know, wartime net all over the surface. And what the scientists came up with, that was actually an electrical mirror. It was acting as a mirror. The question was, what was happening above? And that meant we had to build another craft fitted with the old wartime cameras that the Air Force used, which were 50 volt operated, and fixed on the second unit, the P-12. Then we took that up above the P-11, and then we were amazed. It was brilliant, bright above it, but nothing underneath but the reflection of the trees or clouds. Clouds seemed to appear like a thin purple, gradually getting darker and darker as it moved into the cloud. So we had a mirror effect underneath the vehicle, and we had this immense energy input at the top.
And, John, what was the effect of the people around Warminster and the different villages and the police? What were some of the reactions that you were getting?
Frightened to begin with. The reason was, you see, because I got insulted a bit in the press, I decided I would torment them and see if the stuff we were reading in these UFO books and those of Arthur Shuttleworth was real. And of course, when you take off from this hill in Warminster, just outside Warminster, the buildings are low below the height where we were standing. So we launched them, they would go over the top of the roof And the interesting thing is, take him slowly over, and the tiles on the roof rattle as they try to lift. They rattle. And of course, unfortunate pigeons in the area, they're in a vacuum. So they fall out of the cold sky. And people got completely frightened. All this UFO stuff, aliens, they thought aliens was attacking them. So it was causing quite a press concern.
And then aliens with a vendetta against pigeons.
Yeah. You know, but the way I saw, the police are trained to investigate anything. Would the police follow such a device? And they did. So I toyed. I just kept it going to keep them driving. So when they reported it, at the first, but I didn't know they made a report. I knew nothing until I said Bradley rang me up about it. And this, I mean, remember that they did get out of the vehicle, but then I moved on. I had no idea what happened from then on. But apparently they draw what they saw. And from the newspaper articles that have been sent since, show actually they were drawing the IGV.
Yes, that was that piece of footage that we received a number of years ago.
Yep.
And Vinny, that's very unique footage. You can actually see that on Facebook, John Searle's story. If you look in the back, there's a piece of black and white footage about Warminster, and it has the villagers in a town hall meeting talking about the flying discs that keep each week perpetuating their activity over Warminster. And then there's these two policemen, two constables, that of course are bound to their truthfulness and honesty, and they're describing chasing this disc. And they would chase the disc, and the disc would stop, and then it would run ahead, and they'd chase it some more. And at the end of the footage, they're absolutely telling the truth, and they drew a perfect picture of the Searle disc.
Okay, well, I think that's a good place to leave for break then. We'll be right back in just a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm sorry, Amar, we haven't spoken with you yet. We'll get to you just after the break there. I hope you're okay with that. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Enjoy. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. And my very special guests are Professor John Searle and Bradley Keith and Amar Vakil. And Amar, we wanted to hear from you. What's your part to play in this whole John Searle saga?
Well, my part to play is that John Searle he points out that his law of squares is the main, it's the central theme. And
did he by chance come up with the law of squares in the 60s?
Are you asking me what's my...
That was a joke, by the way, never mind. Continue.
I don't know how to take jokes.
Brunch.
Okay, well, no, I think that when you look at see, my area of expertise is information theory, which I've been doing for two decades, and I'm very specialized in this field. And so
what exactly is information theory like? Because I theorize that certain information exists. Is that what we're talking about?
Well, not quite. In fact, this broadcast that we're having right now, it's all signals transmission data I'm trying to keep this thing really basic. And what happened is in the early 40s, we had a gentleman by the name of Claude Shannon who had pointed out that you can take information and represent it in a mathematical way. So that way you can model how much information you can transmit via bandwidth. What information theory is a science of how to work with data, bits, zeros, and ones. That's what information theory is in a nutshell. What that is it's a mathematical way of representing information, and that's about where I can safely find a closing point there.
So anyway, your relationship with Dr. John Searle.
Well, John Searle is my interest in John Searle was his law of squares. And I said to myself, this thing has some kind of a sequencing numbering system. And could this tell us how he's telling us that it has an internal consistency. That means that you add up all the rows and you all add up the columns, the diagonals, and you get the same number. And I said, well, this has many mathematical rules in it. But at the same time, he points out that you can also use this information to help order sequence materials. So that is how to use the right materials to build the SEG, the proper sequencing of it. And that intrigued me. Could there be two parts to this, two sides to this? One is an existence theorem, so to speak, that could perhaps give us a better understanding of what this squares means as far as nature comes into play, the physical sciences, and the other side, which is the experimental side in the lab, and that is that how he goes about applying this to actually make this happen. Because if it is what it is, it means that the mathematics is telling you an exact formulation in how to build this. And that means if you skirt around it, around this mathematics, you're not going to get the results that John Searle is telling you. So it has to be exactly according to that law. And so that's where I said, let me see if I can expand on this and see if there's more to examine here.
Continue.
Oh, okay. Okay, so I think that that when he's talking about the cooling property in the device, one thing that interests me is that could this sequencing perhaps relate to entropy? Entropy and it has a lot to do with the disorder of a system. And in his sequencing, it is actually telling us the opposite, that there's a pattern. There's some kind of a method in how he goes about formulating this, because those squares that he's using have some kind of self-ordering property in it. So that means that you got the opposite of entropy, of negative entropy. Now, if that's the case, then that means that perhaps his device is giving us a window into a whole new area of physics that we're still beginning to get accustomed to. Okay, I'm trying to be very careful how I say this, because there are many fringes of science right now, and there are many contenders. And at the same time, what we're trying to do is also model or come up with something that can be adaptive, that is motivated by the experiment, to also find the right model that best describes it. So one of the contenders right now has a lot to do with how our universe could very well be information-based. And to see if I can put that in a very easy way of saying that our forces that we normally are accustomed to studying in the fields of physics, in the sciences, we always think of fundamental forces. Well, it could be that the SEG is not displaying a fundamental force. Perhaps it's displaying something that is a little bit more of that is an emergent property of various forces that are coming into play. And that means that it could be information based. And that is, that is going beyond our standard convention of the way physics, and particularly physics, the way physics is covered in the standard literature.
And if I may, Vinny, Amar, we are talking about the face of a three-dimensional cube, correct?
Yes,
And so there's a geometry involved in here. Can you speak to that?
Yes. There's recent work that's being done by folks in areas of string theory and quantum mechanics, general relativity. It's not just one theory. It's many different theories where we're beginning to find that the universe that we reside in, which is space-time, the way it's very mainstream right now, could very well be that it's actually information based at the quantum level. So that means that if you were to study the properties of areas in space-time that are in very extreme cases, like a black hole, for example, it could very well be that the properties there could be pointing to something more information-based. That is to say that essentially everything of space-time collapses down to something much more fundamental at a quantum level, a quantum geometry that is essentially the fundamental landscape of everything that we see. So in other words, space-time is just an emergent property of something much more fundamental. And perhaps and at that level, everything can be reduced down to information. And it could very well be that the law of squares, and this is an opinion that I'm pointing out, this is my opinion, that the law of squares in the cube that you mentioned, Bradley, could very well be a representation of this informational landscape that yes. Everything emerges from.
Yes, and if I may, Vinny, bring in John now. John, you were talking recently about the squares moving into a circle and how that energy moves in and out of the cube as if it's rotating. John, can you speak to that?
Well, unfortunately, we're not showing how you do the square. The point that from the center, it goes, you step by three up. Going down, you're stepping down by three. You come round, and then you start going forward, stepping up by five. From the top, you're going round to the other edge, and you're coming down, stepping down by five. So you've got this vortex effect where the energy is coming in and they meet opposites, then they go out as the alternative, go round, come back in the opposite. In other words, magnetics go out from the object as negative, they will come back as positive. And this applies even in the electron field. You've got electrons going out and those remaining going positive. So the positive then attract, and then positive goes out, but negatives will come in. So you've got always this cycle. Everything has this circle action about it. It's either oscillating or spinning. If it's spinning, it moves away very quick from the material and will then come back again eventually to the other end.
And so just to try to describe that for the radio, you have a 4x4 block of 16 squares, each with a value in them, and they're arranged from uniform to random, and I guess we'll pick that up on the after side. Yeah, Vinny?
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like when you go to school and you're the only one wearing musty uniform to random. We'll be right back after the break at the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. Ladies and gentlemen, don't you go anywhere.